everyone. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Join me in a chant of Om Shri Ram. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om. Shri
Jai Jai Ramo.
Reading from Papa Ramdas, Call of the Devotee, Teachings of Krishna and Christ. Whenever Ramdas was invited for bhajan and bhiksha to the houses of devotees, he was invariably asked to deliver a discourse on some spiritual subject selected by the host. He spoke mainly on three topics, Ramnam, Satsang, and the goal of life. For self-purification, Ramdas emphasized that there is no simpler way than chanting of the divine name. In the society of saints, God, who resides in the heart of the aspirant, gradually revealed himself. The experience of the devotee's union with God was simply wonderful. The devotee felt that he was one with the beloved and was still his lover. In his speeches, Ramdas compared and reconciled the teachings of Krishna and Christ. Krishna said, the highest vision was to realize God within oneself as well as in all beings and creatures. Christ taught, the kingdom of God is within you. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Here Ramdas pointed out thyself should have a capital S in the self, as it stood for God himself. This command of Christ should be put into practice only if you beheld the divine in your neighbor, even as you are conscious of him in yourself. And from Mother's Library, East West Magazine, this is from April 1932. The Baptism of Jesus Christ, Matthew 3:13. Then cometh Jesus from Galilee to Jordan, unto John, to be baptized of him. But John would have hindered him, saying, I have need to be baptized of thee, and comest thou to me? But Jesus answering said unto him, Suffer it now, for thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. Then he baptized, went straight away from the water, and lo, the heavens were opened unto him. And he saw the Spirit of God descending as a dove, coming upon him, and lo, a voice out of the heavens saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Intuitional Interpretation of Yogada, Hindu, and Christian Baptism. The original ceremony of baptism by water came from India. Baptism means immersion in water in order to cleanse or purify. Purification of the body should precede the purification of the mind. Hence, all souls who desired to begin living the spiritual life had to purify their bodies. Cleanliness is next to godliness, but baptism of the body, unless followed by baptism of the mind, becomes practically meaningless. If we bathe and thus purify our bodies, we will find that our mind will temporarily become purified. But unless we change our soul's wickedness by calmness and meditation and constant spiritual vigilance, we will remain the same old devils with bad habits in spite of our temporary purifying effect of the water on the bodies. To illustrate this metaphorically, a Hindu saint said, to his would-be disciple, Son, it is necessary to bathe in the Ganges to purify the mind from sin. The sins will leave you temporarily while you bathe in the holy waters, but they will wait for you in the trees skirting the Ganges, and as soon as you come out of the sacred influence of the holy water, they will again jump on you. It must be remembered, however, that bodily baptism by water has its good points. The custom in India is to take spiritual lessons from a holy man only immediately after bathing. To take spiritual lessons with a sweaty, unclean body is not effective. The Baptists do well to immerse their initiates in water, but the ceremony of immersion, without following up with continued spiritual lessons in meditation and God contact, is of little value. The aristocratic, modern way of baptism consists in sprinkling water on the head. This is all that is left of the original custom of purifying the body by water. Baptism by sprinkling of water may be all right for most civilized people, for they usually bathe themselves daily. Then, too, immersion of initiates in water may be unnecessary if they are mentally evolved. But sprinkling of water on the head of evolved people is unnecessary unless this is done only out of respect to the ancient baptismal ceremonies. It is evident that Jesus, although he had so evolved, did not fail to go into the water. He did not fully immerse, for the river of Jordan was practically dry at that time. Thus, it is all right for spiritually minded people to bathe before being baptized. But it is also true that in modern America, many aristocratic people would refuse to be baptized if they had the prospect of a second bath in church. They would rather forego entering heaven than be publicly immersed in water. For such people, spiritual instruction without this second bath is all right. Another important matter in connection with the baptism of Jesus Christ is that he insisted on being baptized by John, who in self-realization was far inferior to him. John said he was not worthy to unloose the latchet of the shoes of Jesus, and that he baptized only with water, while Jesus baptized with spirit. Alas, modern baptism has become baptism by water only. Yogada methods are showing the real way of baptizing the self with spirit, and ultimately, wisdom. Feeling his spiritual inferiority, John wondered why Jesus wanted to be baptized with water. This action of Jesus distinctly demonstrated the ancient pre-Christian Hindu custom and the real spiritual way which every God aspirant should follow. The method of finding God is different from the methods demanded by most colleges for any kind of specific training. Even in medical training, the student never learns if he roams from college to college, joining different medical institutions and listening to a few lectures, but without going through intensive training in materia medica, physiology, dissection, and other studies in college. Also, it is true that a student cannot join all the universities at the same time. A student should follow one course in one college until he receives a certificate that he has completed certain studies. But alas, in spiritual denominations, even the loyalty of the usual intellectual college expects is not given to the denomination by the aspirant, nor is the time necessary for self-realization given to the practice of spiritual lessons by thousands of students in the Western world. Such people continue taking lessons from any new, good, bad, or indifferent teachers who happen to come to town advertise. I say that people should discriminate between the so-called teacher who uses religion only to make money or just a living, and the real teacher who may use business methods in his religion in order to serve his brethren with real spirituality. It is extremely necessary to remember that in the beginning it is wise to compare many spiritual paths and teachers. But when the real guru or preceptor and the real teachings is found, then the restless searching must cease. The thirsty one should not keep seeking wells, but go on to the best well and daily drink its nectar. That is why in India, in the beginning, we seek many until we find the right path and the right master, and then remain loyal to him through death and eternity until final emancipation. We can have many teachers first, but only one guru, and no more teachers afterwards. Teachers call those who come to learn from them students, but a guru calls the spiritual aspirant who comes to him a disciple. Jesus himself said, "None cometh to the Father but by me." This signifies that human souls are mostly truant children of God, roaming away from him in the wilderness of suffering. Such souls are impelled by glimpses of their lost home of spiritual blessedness. they begin to long for God and inwardly pray for a way of the out of the conundrum of life. Then the prayers of such errant children become deep and strong enough. God is touched and sends help. It is then that the one Father of all sends a Superman on earth to give help to the lost seeking souls. Such a man ordained by God to help the individual in response to deep prayers is not an ordinary teacher, but a guru or a vehicle whose body, speech, mind, and spirituality God Himself uses to bring lost souls back to the home of immortality. In the Hindu scriptures and whispers from eternity, it is written, "As a naughty baby, I cried for my mother divine, and she came to me as my guru. My guru, I found thee in response to my soul cries. If all the gods are displeased, and yet, O guru, if thou art pleased, I am safe in the fortress of thy pleasure. But if all the gods protect me by the parapets of their blessings, yet I receive not thy benediction, I am an orphan, left to pine spiritually in the ruins of thy pleasure, in the ruins of thy displeasure. Together, guru and disciple will fly to his shores, and then we will smash our planes of old finite forever and vanish into the infinite life." The above depiction of guru and disciple depicts the real way to retrace the truant soul's footsteps back to God. This guru and disciple relationship is not the enslaving relationship between the blind church or temple members and the ignorant so-called priests or of a temple or church elected by God, but by the temple of the church organization or by higher church dignitary honored by orthodox followers but unknown to God. My guru said to me, "Allow me to discipline you, for freedom of will consists of not doing things according to the dictates of prenatal or postnatal habits or mental whims, but according to the suggestions of wisdom and free choice." He continued, "If you tune in your will with mine, you will find freedom. Formerly, my will was guided by habits, but when I tuned it with God-guided, wisdom-guided will of my guru, I found freedom." To tune in with a soul whose will is guided by wisdom is to find freedom of will. Most teachers who slavishly control their students after the pattern of dogmatic teachings destroy the power of free will in them. But obedience to a guru does not produce spiritual blindness in the disciple. On the contrary, it develops his third eye of wisdom and intuition. Most teachers want their students to see through the teacher's eyes, but a guru disciplines the disciple only until he can guide himself through wisdom. A guru, a preceptor, is sent by God. If a disciple, after following a guru for a long time, should spurn him, then he actually spurns the help sent by God. A guru is not a help for this life only. He also makes a spiritual soul contact with the disciple and says, "Let our friendship be eternal, and let us help each other through incarnations until we are both completely emancipated in spirit." Sometimes, likewise, an advanced disciple can help a guru and vice versa. Such friendship is not based on any selfish consideration or on any condition. Such divine friendship and perpetual goodwill expressed between two or more souls gives to the ever-pure, unselfish, all-emancipating divine love. My master said to me, "I will be your friend from now until eternity. No matter whether you are on the lowest mental plane or on the highest plane of wisdom, I will be your friend if you ever should err, for then you will need my friendship more than any other time." When I accepted my master's unconditional friendship, he said, "Will you be my friend under all circumstances?" Will you protect me in the highest or in the lowest strata of mind? I was amazed. I was stupefied. For how could I dream of my master being in the lowest strata? But until I vowed to be his friend always, under all circumstances, he did not rest. He did not rest. He was gladdened when I said, I will be thine always. It was then, after this amazing spiritual compact, that I understood the significance of a guru, and really I never found complete satisfaction, comfort, and God consciousness until I attuned myself in with the divine consciousness of my master. Jesus knew of the above law of emancipation. He must have found in John his reincarnated guru. A guru, although inferior in spiritual quality, is a guru just the same, a vehicle of God always. That is why Jesus insisted on being baptized by John the Baptist. Jesus also had spoken of John the Baptist as the reincarnated prophet Elias, or Elijah. Next, in connection with the baptism of Jesus Christ, it is important to remember the spiritual baptism and the spiritual experiences of Jesus, which followed by his physical baptism with water by John. This will be explained further in the next issue. The spiritual interpretations are the result of a long unfulfilled promise to Yogacara students, and they are also methods by which Master have taken to Shaun the world, the common scientific platform of intuitive perception. So these are wonderful readings from Master. It's interesting that they date back to 1932. Wisdom is eternal, though, isn't it? It's always, if it's true then, it's always true. I marvel, though, that Master was a young man still when he came to America. And the tremendous wisdom that he had and his expression in English, which was a foreign language to him when he first came to America, is really quite stunning, I think. It brings forward many, many relevant things here. But this baptism of spirit is something that I would like to speak to you this morning. The physical baptism, as Master was speaking here, is a wonderful thing when it is done in the proper spirit. There are many people who have gone down to the riverbank and in older days and would actually be completely immersed in the water. When I first went to India, I had heard about the Ganges being sacred and holy and that it had special properties to it and so on. And when you actually get to the Ganges, particularly lower down, it carries a lot of sediment with it, as well as just about anything else you can think of you see being carried by you, including dead bodies that have been wrapped up in cloth. And so it's not considered safe for drinking at that point, or maybe even bathing. But when I went through a certain experience when I was up in the Himalayas, we were at a temple there. It was a Yogacara Satsang temple. And there was an individual who was sitting in the congregation. And while other people were meditating, he was putting himself through very strange breathing exercises. And he was quite noisy in the effects that he was making. And it was not a comfortable kind of situation. And as it progressed along, it came to me very powerfully that he was practicing tantric exercises in order to gain powers. And this tremendous sense of foreboding and darkness was around him, and then it was around me. And there I was sitting in meditation and keeping my mind on God, but this kind of dark cloud, it seemed, was surrounding me. And when I walked out of the temple, there was a dog that was kept on the grounds there, and from the very first time that I'd walked in, we'd always been on friendly terms with each other. He always came up with me, to me, wagging his tail and the smile on his face as I had pet him, and so we got along very nicely together. He'd follow me out on walks, out on the roads there, and he's a wonderful being inside of this dog. He must have been in order to be kept on an ashram like that. But when he saw me this time, after coming out of the temple, he started barking at me, and he backed up. And he wouldn't come anywhere near me, and I was aware that this dark, clouded force was still surrounding me. There was another dog further down the lane that we were also on good terms with each other, and when I approached him, and because dogs oftentimes perceive things that people don't, this dog also started barking at me, where before he would come up and I would give him a pet. The dogs up in the north are treated in general much different than the ones in the south, and they're treated more like house pets rather than a plague, as they are oftentimes in the south. And so as I came back to the place where we were living at the time, I was aware that this darkness was surrounding me. And it was really something. It was something to have to fight through. And I kept my mind on God and kept going that way, and I felt my connection with God, so it didn't interfere with that. But still I could feel this darkness surrounding me. And it kept on for some time until we left Dwarahat, where we were at. We descended by the bus down through the layers, and eventually we went to Benares. And Benares is right on the Ganges. And we stayed at a hotel where the steps of the hotel went right down into the Ganges. And I had bathed a couple times in the Ganges, and it had been an all right experience. Mostly, at the time, I was very hot, and it was very humid, and so it felt wonderful getting into these cool waters and taking a dip that way. But I still had this dark force around me. And when I got into the Ganges and immersed myself into it, I felt much of this dark force being swept away into the river. And it was the first time that I felt really the spiritual effect of the Ganges. Later on, we went to another ashram that was at the foothills of the Himalayas, where it first comes into the plains, and at an ashram called Phool Chati. Phool Chati means place of many flowers, and they raise beautiful roses there. And I went down to the Ganges there, and here it was quite cold. It was more fed from the glaciers, and it was very, very frigid kind of feeling. So it was a rather quick dip when I got into this one, and the mud was very kind of sticky. If we had worn shoes, it would have pulled them off, but we were barefooted, and so it was sandy and sticky like that. And taking a dip down into the Ganges, again, I felt the spiritually purifying effect of it, because I was still having some of the residue of this dark force. There's another stream that fed into it right there that was quite a bit warmer, and it was there that we took our baths because of the warmer water. And there I could compare and contrast the effects of the two rivers. And the stream that was feeding into it didn't have the same spiritually purifying effect the Ganges did. And so for the first time, really, I felt the effect of what was being talked about so many times with the Ganges, that I experienced for myself the purifying of vibration and effect that this river has. Now, why it has it exactly, I don't know. Perhaps it's had so many saints and beings of realization meditate by its banks, bathe in its waters, that it's taken on this kind of form. Perhaps there's other reasons as well. but it has this wonderful purifying effect to it. So it showed me that immersing yourself in water, particularly a sacred river, and perhaps the Jordan has a similar kind of an effect. I don't know. I haven't been there and been bathed in it, so I don't know. But the Ganges definitely does. And so this is a wonderful aspect of baptism, and it is the outer baptism. And certainly water is very purifying to the electrical body or the astral body. If you've ever had a difficult day at work or you've been around people who are very negative and you feel that negativity just surrounding you like a coat that's following you around and surrounding all around you, you can take a shower or a bath and it will help to cleanse you of that vibration, because everything in the physical realm has its astral correspondence. And so water, too, has an astral vibration or energy. And when you are around purified water, it has its effect upon your own, not only physical body, but your energy body as well. So these things are borne out through our own experiences, and we feel the difference. That is the outer baptism. Then there is the inner baptism. And the inner baptism comes when you are spiritually or energetically purified. There was a time when Larry and I came into knowledge of some things that one of Master's disciples had been doing, or was at least accused of doing, and it seemed that there was merit to at least some of the accusations, and it wasn't good. It wasn't what a spiritual man should be doing, and it certainly isn't what a Swami should be doing. And we both had felt just a kind of being sullied in the, again, in the energy field. It was just something that seemed to hang on to us. Marge Ranney had given us some pictures that had been taken when they were in India, and some of them were just of travel in different places. But we were looking on it from a slide projector up on the screen. And suddenly, up came the picture of Meher Baba, one of the great masters of India. And Mother had sent Marge specifically to see Meher Baba, even though Mother had never met Meher Baba in the body. She had a great feeling of regard for him and his state of realization. And when this picture flashed up, and I had seen his books, I had tried to read one of them, and I didn't get anywhere with it at all. And I had seen his pictures, and they had been all right. But when this picture flashed up on the screen, when Larry and I compared notes later, we found that we both had the same experience. And when that picture came up, we both felt cleansed, like an emanation of light came out from that picture, and it cleansed both of us of this sullied kind of feeling that we'd been carrying around with us for several days. And so this was a baptism of light, a spiritual baptism that comes. Also, when Mother gave initiation, and she would touch us on the third eye point as we received her blessings. And I remember in 1984, when Mother gave her last Kriya ceremony, and when she put her finger upon my ajna there, I felt a burning vibration there that lasted for quite some time. There's an emanation that comes out from realized beings. And particularly when you find your guru, as Master defined here, a guru is not an ordinary teacher. Or we may distinguish between Appa Guru and Sat Guru. An Appa Guru is a teacher that we have in life, somebody that we learn from, somebody that we are edified from. But a guru is a singular, a satguru is that one that God has sent to take you into the state of complete realization. Now that guru must be in a state of realization themselves in order to lift you beyond the bounds of ignorance. Otherwise they cannot serve in that role. And it is something that is given to them as a guru from God and from Guru. And so we observe and we see these guru-disciple lineages that have stretched down through time. I feel most fortunate that we are connected with this guru lineage coming from Jesus and Babaji, because Jesus asked Babaji to send someone to the West in order to bring these teachings here. And so Mother always identified that Jesus and Babaji were at the head of our spiritual guru lineage. And from there, Lahiri Mahasaya, Swami Sri Yukteswarji, Master and Mother. And what a tremendous spiritual lineage we belong to. It is up to us as individuals to make the spiritual effort. Just having a guru in and of itself is not sufficient. There are many people who are initiated, but how many really work the program, do what is asked by the guru, and put into effect the teachings that they received? You see, there is a responsibility by each one of us. We cannot just take initiation or say that we are a follower and not be doing what it is that we've been asked to do. As Jesus said, it is not all who say, Lord, Lord, who are my disciples. It is those who follow what I say. We must put into action those principles that we are given. When we do, we begin to make spiritual progress. Now, in the beginning, it's like fighting upstream, because all of our tendencies and notions tend to carry us away from the divinity that we inwardly have known to be there. Intuitively or through our own experience, we know that it's there. But it's like swimming upstream, so we have to make effort. Our default will be go to the ego nature and be limited by the human mind. And so as Master says here, when you get your guru, when you get your spiritual path, you really put your attention on it. You can't be continuing to wander from here to there. That just becomes an activity of the mind. It's not that we can't continue to educate ourselves and to read for inspiration and to feel an upliftment in mind. But a voracity of reading without its corresponding inward depth of meditation is staying on the surface. It's a way of avoiding going deeper. There are so many things that make us resistant to going deeper in God. There's physical restlessness. There's restlessness of the mind. There's desire nature. There are our fears. And they all come up, and they all challenge us from going into the depths of our own being so that we may soar into the heights of spiritual consciousness. So this is something that we have to keep our shoulder to the wheel. We have to keep on making spiritual effort. And there are so many reasons in order to stay away. When Sri Yukteswar met Master, he asked him, he said, I want you to promise me one thing, that you will not avoid me. And Master made that promise, but Master went on to say that was the most difficult promise that he ever had to fulfill. It's because the guru represents the highest spiritual vibration, and it's tough on the ego, and the ego doesn't like it. And so the ego starts to look for excuses of why to stay away, why to avoid the guru. And there are many reasons, and there are many things that come up. But I loved what Master wrote here and what Sri Yukteswar made him promise to, even if I fall into the lowest depths. I want you to promise that you will always be there, that you will never go away. Can you imagine such a thing? Wouldn't that be shocking to hear? And Master certainly described himself as shocked. What? How could this spiritually great being whom I'm beholding here before my eyes be talking about falling into the depths? And yet, it's that unconditional love. It's that unconditional willingness to throw ourselves heart, mind, and soul. Now, when I was born into this life, I brought with me a habit pattern that was to hold myself back. I always wanted to observe. I always wanted to get the scope of things. But you know what? I never really put myself 100% into anything. Now, in the beginning, that's because I didn't find anything in this world worth putting myself 100% into. But when I began to really go into the spiritual path, I understood that this was my calling. This was the truth for me. And yet, I found myself enacting the same old pattern. I wasn't putting both feet into the circle. I had one foot in, I had one foot out. Because I always wanted an outlet. I always wanted a safety valve. What if things went south? What if things didn't go the way that I wanted them to go? Maybe I could just make my escape and get out of here. And it wasn't until Mother called me on that I really had to make a decision. Could I love her completely? Could I love her completely? That's really quite a task. Because the Guru is both human and divine. And if we really want to make a case for it, we can find some reason to find fault with the Guru. It's easy to do. Easy to do. And yet, we are called upon to find the divine, not only in the Guru, but in all beings, in all creation. And so I really struggled with myself around that one. Could I, would I, make that kind of commitment of heart, mind, and soul? And the biggest test that I had that I can recall right now is when Mother was in a nursing home. She had had several strokes. She had had shingles so that it looked like half of her face was filled with leprosies, open, oozing sores. She had had a heart attack. She was really in bad shape physically and mentally. I went into the nursing home where she is currently staying, and there she sat, looking like a little old woman. She had a kind of a blank stare and drool was coming out one side of her mouth because it was paralyzed from the stroke. Now, this was the same one who was the most powerful, the most intelligent, the wisest of all that I had ever met in my life. And I wasn't even sure that Mother recognized me. Perhaps she did or she didn't. We had very little conversation. And when I left there, I was really shaken. And I thought to myself, what in the world is going on here? What in the world is going on? And I had the time and I went home. I sat down on my meditation blanket and I asked God, what is going on here? What is all of this? And I sat there for a very, very long time. And after that long time of sitting and concentrating on God, calming my mind, calming my body, finally a wonderful revelation came. And there I saw with my inner vision the most beautiful and glorious image of Mother, filled with light. And light was extending out in every direction as far as my mind's eye could see. And Mother was so beautiful in this light, so powerful. And she said, don't you know, through thought, she said this, not in words, but through thought, transferred itself directly to my mind. Don't you know I am in my light body? And that resolved the question for me. It resolved the doubt for me. And I realized that I had been measuring this great God woman through her physical manifestation. And that for all of us, our physical manifestation is but a tiny, tiny little aspect of who we really are. But isn't it true that most of us are mostly conscious of our physical manifestation? Most of us are aware of this body and what the mind says, and we're limited by that. We're limited by it. But through this inward spiritual baptism that I received from Mother in that moment, it cleared away my doubts, and I never entertained a doubt again. And through all the different experiences that Mother had to go through in the physical body, it never disturbed or distressed me in the same kind of way again. There's a time when she is standing up and she is doing the very best she could to serve. She always did that to the very last breath, anything she could do to serve God and us all. And she is giving a talk probably at a time when she should not have been, because she had such a great desire to serve. And I was sitting up behind her. Usually my eyes were closed, as they are now. But I just happened to open my eyes, and when I did, I saw Mother weaving back and forth as she was standing at the podium. And I knew that something was wrong, and suddenly she collapsed. And I just, because I was looking at her, I was able to get to her and swoop her up in my arms. And that poor little body didn't weigh very much at that time. And I lifted her up, and I took her to Billy's car, and we put her into the car and drove her right to the nearby hospital at Northwest. And she had had a stroke as she was giving a talk there. That was her willingness, her desire to serve everybody, to lift everyone into the higher realms of consciousness. But how many could appreciate her willingness to sacrifice herself and to give herself so totally and so completely? And this is just one small example of what she did so many times that she came and she would talk to all of us at a time when physically she didn't feel like it at all, because she knew what she experienced in God consciousness. She knew the freedom, she knew the bliss, she knew the wisdom. And she wanted that for all of us, with all of her heart, with all of her mind, with all of her soul. And every time that she spoke, I felt a spiritual radiance and power and vibration go out so powerfully that I felt baptized in that vibration. And I remember the first couple of years that I came, I would think to myself, will it be the same this time? And every time it was, and I felt that same uplifting spiritual power, and it was tremendous, it was powerful. This spiritual baptism that we can receive, whether directly from God or from Guru, or from a spiritual master or from a holy site, these things are absolutely essential. In the transformation, we can think that we can do it all ourselves, going to God, but there is no way. No way. Because the human mind and the human ego cannot transcend itself. It cannot transcend itself. It does not have the power to do so. So at some point, the ego has to be left behind. The limitations of the human mind has to be left behind. But we cling on to it, as if it is our nearest and dearest friend. We don't want to let it go because it's what's known to us. It's what makes us feel in control. But truly, as Master says here, when we surrender to that degree, we really find our free will. Because we have been emancipated from the dictator of the human ego. And we have resurrected into the divine will and the divine self. As we surrender to that, we really discover our true freedom. That's one of the ultimate paradoxes of the spiritual journey and our spiritual path. So let us, each one of us, put forward our best foot, and not just when we're around spiritual family or when other people are watching, but at all times. Let us seek to purify body, mind, and soul so that it can be a fit conduit for divine consciousness. This is no small undertaking, but it is possible. It is possible for you to experience your oneness with the divine creator of all. And when you do, you will never look back on any effort that you have made along the way with any regret at all. You will think to yourself, why didn't I do it sooner? Why didn't I make a greater effort along the way? Why did I get so distracted? And you will feel that tremendous uplifting power, that joy, that love, that light. And there is no end to it. With every human experience, there is an end. No matter how much we like a thing or a person, things change. And ultimately, we leave it all behind because we leave this body behind. There is only one thing that is eternal, and that is your soul. That is your spirit, your true self. So that is why we realize the true self with a capital S. That is why these great prophets, Krishna, Christ, and so many others have come, is to awaken that knowledge in us, not for us to be slavish followers, but for us to come into our own complete and total realization. So let us dedicate ourselves to that and be spiritually baptized through and through and through until every cell of your being is sparkling, cleansed of any darkness, any difficulty, any obstruction of the divine light, until every cell of your being is shining, gleaming, glowing, and is able to spread that light to one and all that it comes into proximity of. This is the great joy of living. It is the great purpose for what you have come. Now, if you'll pray with me, O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my being.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Yesterday we had a funeral service for a kitty, Kink, who was buried in the yard here. And as we closed the funeral service for this little soul, I asked for there to be ohms to send Kink's soul all the way into heaven. And you know, as we chanted those ohms, I felt that vibration go out and just as a beautiful radiance lifting that kitty soul all the way into heavenly realms.